Hey, gorgeous lady, how you doing?
Hello, beautiful. I am so much better because I got to see you this week.
Yes.
And I haven't seen you in way too fucking long, since before Christmas.
Yeah, I did the math as to when it was. It was when we got our palms red.
Yes. Oh my God, I love you.
Yeah.
I love that you did the research.
I did, because I was like fucked up about it. I was like, when was the last time I saw you?
I know. I was really worried it was Donna's Halloween party. And then I was like, fuck, has it really been since October? That can't be right. That doesn't feel right.
I think it was the end of November. So pretty close.
Not much better, but that makes me feel slightly better.
Same. It was so great to see you, as usual.
Same.
I love you. I adore you.
I love you and I adore you. We had so many presents.
Oh my God, so many presents. One of which I'm wearing right meow.
It looks so cute.
It is a cropped hoodie. And even though I don't do a crop, it's like the correct length of crop that it's acceptable for me.
Yes, I tried. I was very concerned about that, but I was like, I think it's okay.
You nailed it. It is a tarot card with a skeleton. And it's, I believe, the number 11. And it is the Audacity is the tarot card. It's incredible.
As I just told Monique, it was one of those things where I saw it and I wanted to immediately buy it for myself. And then I was like, no, this is perfect for one person and one person only. And it's not me. It's Monique. Don't be a selfish bitch and buy it for Monique instead.
And I told Amy that I have the exact same impulse with like 90% of the things I give her, except I pull the trigger on it and I buy one for myself and for Amy. So I'm just turning Amy's apartment into my apartment.
I'm not mad about it. In fact, when you told me that, I immediately was like, oh, that's fucking brilliant. Why don't I just do that? Amy, you silly goose. You could have been twinning with Monique this entire time. Why are you being like this?
Our souls are twinning. That's what matters.
That is one true and two, one of the most beautiful things anyone's ever said to me.
I love that. I love you.
Monique bought me fantastic gifts, not only for me, but also for Boo.
Oh my God, yes.
Which Boo's might be my favorite. She bought him two little cat toy stuffies, one which is a bloody knife and one which is a bloody cleaver. And they have like a little pocket for catnip. So I put catnip in the cleaver one the other day because I was like, oh, let's see if he likes it. Dude went ham. I could barely get a photo of him because he was going so fucking crazy and moving so much.
I love
it. It is so funny and cute to see this like tiny, adorable little kitten with this like bloody little cleaver. I kept texting everyone the pictures and being like, my little axe murderer. I love it.
I love it. Oh my God. I love it so much.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you from Boo.
Of course.
I know he appreciates it. And yeah, you got me so many amazing things. She got me mushroom glasses, like drinking glasses, that I had admired at a brunch restaurant we went to probably like fucking a year ago, a year and a half ago or something.
Yeah, it was like 16 months ago, something like that.
Like it was a deep cut. Like that was a callback I was not expecting. And
oh yeah.
Just proves how amazing you are at gift giving, really, truly.
Thank you. That's the Monique Sanchez gift-giving experience.
I would not trade it for the world. It's amazing. If you have the opportunity to experience it, good for you. Appreciate it.
I love you. Thank you so much. You're so sweet.
Oh my God, I love you. What else have you been doing with your week when I wasn't hanging out with you?
I hung out with Donna and some friends.
Fun.
I hung out with my honey. Mostly, it's working on the fun, exciting things coming down the pike for the pod is really what I've been doing.
I know. I'm excited.
Which I know you've been doing too.
I've been doing too. We're hard at work, busy little bees.
Mm-hmm. Which is fun because that's like 90% of the reason we hung out.
Yes. Which is
amazing.
Business ladies doing business. I love it.
I know. Do you have a businesswoman discount?
Oh my God, I wish.
I know, right? Fuck. That for those who don't know, that's from Romy Michelle's high school reunion, which I saw for the first time like 6 months ago.
I haven't seen that in for fucking ever.
You know what? It's fucking great.
I loved that movie.
And like everyone ever is in that movie.
I gotta rewatch that.
Yeah, girl.
I did not even get the reference. That's how long it's been. I feel like I watched it in like high school, maybe the last time in college.
Yeah, the movie's high key insane. Like it's incredible.
That's why I loved it.
Yeah.
Because I'm high-key insane.
But, like, everyone is in this movie. Fucking Janine Garofalo, Justin Theroux, Alan Cumming.
Oh.
Like, yes.
I remembered Janine Garofalo and Alan Cumming. I did not remember Justin Theroux being in this, but he, I feel like it was in pretty much everything during that time. So that tracks.
Yeah. And he wasn't, like, really a thing at that time.
Yeah.
But he plays the, like, broody guy who's always smoking cigarettes.
I mean, it's a vibe. I'm into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this was pre-Charlie's Angels days, maybe? Maybe not?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. I have no concept of time anymore, genuinely. Like, it could be a year, it could be 10 years. I have no fucking idea.
Girl, same. Time is a flat circle. Speaking of, did you watch it?
Okay, no, don't hate me. I'm so behind. Okay, no,
I don't hate you. I don't hate you. You're totally fine.
Okay. I know. You really hyped me up for it because we talked a little bit about it with no spoilers when I saw you, and I was very excited, but I promised Johnny I wasn't going to watch it without him.
Because Amy's a much better girlfriend than I am. I've been like, sucks to be you, bruh.
That, and also, we don't have Max, and he's been, like, downloading it somehow. I didn't ask any questions.
Legally, of course.
Of course. Of course.
Don't come for us.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on. Magic happened behind the scenes, and we had the episode somehow. But yeah, I didn't know how to do it without him. So he actually secretly had all the power, and I didn't realize until he was gone. And then I was like, oh, I can't even secretly watch it without him, without, like, signing up for Max and then doing all this bullshit.
That sucks.
Yeah.
But the creator of the show, Nick, whatever the fuck his name is, has been, like, retweeting every tweet of people shitting on the show or on the finale.
Why is he being such a hater? Stop drinking the haterade. Like, Jesus Christ.
I don't. Like, why are you so upset that this was more successful than the last two seasons you did, other than the statement I just said? Grow up.
Yeah. This just seems sad and, like, petty and pathetic.
Like, to steal a line from Mariah, why are you so obsessed with me?
100% Yes.
Move on, bro.
Yeah.
Do something else.
If you really wanted to disown it, you didn't give a shit. Stop fucking talking about it.
Like, no one asked you.
Yeah.
Literally.
You're like the fucking guy who can't stop talking about his ex-girlfriend. Like, bro, you broke up.
Yeah.
Stop bringing her up. Move on.
Literally.
Haters gonna hate. Whatever.
I mean, girl. But to go back to the audacity really quick, I just want to shout out Sam, who – actually, I'm going to shout out two Sams. One, Sam from Chicago. It was her birthday the other day. Happy birthday, queen.
Happy birthday, Sam.
And then I'm going to shout out the other Sam who works at a bar in my neighborhood and who's also queen. Hey, girl. So I went in to her place of business the other day, and she told me that she was catching up on episodes and that there was one episode where we kept saying this bitch and the audacity. So that now whenever Faith Hill's This Kiss comes on, she has rewritten it to go, this bitch, this bitch. The audacity. And it's incredible.
Better than the original. You're welcome. I love it.
If you find yourself doing that, thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Sam. I will never hear that song the same way again. And I'm actually happier about that.
Absolutely. We're all the better for it.
Yes. Also, I am such a fan of, like, rewriting the lyrics to songs. My dad used to do that when I was growing up. And Johnny does it. It's something I, like, still do to this day. It makes me so happy. And that's one of the better ones I've ever heard. I'm not going to lie.
I mean, yeah, Weird Al fucking nailed it.
Such a Weird Al fan. I love it.
Ah, so good.
That does mean there are still songs to this day that I sing the incorrect lyrics to, because I will never sing the correct lyrics anymore.
Oh, for sure. Do I know more of Amish Paradise than Gangster's Paradise? Absolutely. Yes.
That's amazing. This is why I love you. This and so many other things, but this is just cementing my love for you.
Likewise. I adore you.
I adore you.
What about you? Any things, any fun things that you've been up to?
I haven't done anything too crazy besides going to see you. That was, like, my big hurrah for the week. I started watching Resident Alien, which kept getting recommended to me on Netflix.
Yep.
Not gonna lie, kind of obsessed.
Amazing.
It's really funny. It has a lot of really wonderful cameos. I don't want to spoil any of them, but one of them actually just genuinely made me laugh out loud.
Is it a weekly show or like a full drop?
So there's seasons one and two, full seasons on Netflix right now.
Okay, fun.
So you can binge away.
Yeah, the only thing that I really have been watching is continuing to watch Feud Capote versus the Swans. That's great. Everyone's nailing it. I knew nothing of the story.
Is this a dramatization of?
Yes.
Okay.
It's really great. Highly recommend.
I know nothing of the story. What is this on?
Oh, it's on FX, so Hulu, the next day. And it's about Truman Capote and how he was friends with all of these socialites that he referred to as swans, because I don't know if this is true or accurate, but according to him, while swans are more beautiful than ducks traditionally, and they just seem to like glide around, they actually have to pedal two times as fast as ducks, and that can often like even drown in the weight of their own plumage. So it's kind of like this metaphor of like, these women seem like they have it on, that they're beautiful, but they actually have struggles to make it look like they're perfect.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so his last work, which is an unfinished novel that was going to be called Answered Prayers, he released a chapter of it to Esquire and basically blew up all of these women's spots and like the dirty, dirty details of their lives, like who's fucking who, whose husband's fucking who, like dirty details in Esquire. And then They were like, fuck you. And like did like kind of like a social hit campaign on Truman Capote and like iced him out of like New York society and how it basically led to his demise.
That sounds fascinating. I had not heard of any of that.
Yeah, me neither. It's really great.
Okay. I have to check this out.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned before, I don't know if I brought it up on the show, but Tom Hollander, who plays the like head gay in season two of White Lotus, plays Truman Capote, and he's like fucking crushing it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm even more excited to watch it now.
Oh, it's great. Highly recommend it. I think there's 5 episodes out right now. They're about an hour long each.
Okay. It's in the process of airing then.
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's another one or two left, but it's great. So while you wait for Johnny to do his magic, and you want something a little bit more serious than Resident Alien, check it out. It's really good.
I will. I know. I've been in a very lighthearted watching mood lately.
Yeah. And one of our favorite podcasts came back.
Yes.
What Went Wrong?
Fuck. I still didn't listen to that either. I'm so behind on everything.
Oh, it's great. It's really fascinating. I didn't realize. So the first episode back is basically the pilot episode of Lost. And then episode 2 is going to be like, I think, the cultural impact and then the finale.
Oh, okay.
Because you can't like, there's like how many there's fucking so, seasons?
Yeah,
you can't
Jesus. Go through that. I was going to say, yeah. I don't know how they covered all of it. I'm sure it's insane.
It's fucking nuts. It's really fascinating and really interesting because realistically, with the exception of like Dominic Moynihan, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Everyone was basically an unknown. And they get into why that is. It wasn't like a cool, like, we're just going to cast only people. But basically, they were so behind in the production schedule that everyone else was already booked for a pilot. And no one was available.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
And then that just made these people fucking superstars overnight. Who, like, apparently Evangeline Lilly had, like, done a commercial and played, like, a dead body. And that was her entire resume.
No way.
Yeah, girl.
Lucky break for all of them, honestly.
Right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. I mean, it's great. I love that podcast. I love a factoid, especially about film or TV. So that's back. Check it out if you're into it, especially if you're a Lost fan.
I'm not going to lie. The amount I like went to check to see if a new episode had been released, even though I knew they were taking a break, was embarrassing until finally there was like the little blurb that was like, we're coming back on the 19th. And I was like, oh my God, finally.
Oh, I didn't even know when they were coming back. It just showed up in my phone. I was like, oh, amazing.
Yeah, I'm very behind. Okay, I need to do that. I need to do that too. We literally talked about it. And I was like, I'm going to go listen to that when I get home. And then I did not. I went to sleep.
Yeah, correct.
Yes.
Anything else? Are we going into some spooky, spooky territory?
No, that is my big excitement for the week. I'm super pumped for the paranormal story this week. Are you ready?
I am super pumped as well. Yes.
Awesome. I'm so glad. On that note, I watched a new paranormal show this week.
Oh.
So my main source is The Haunted Season 1, Episode 1 or 4, depending on your source. I feel like this seems like a very generic name for a show, and maybe there's a show on Netflix that's called this as well. It's not that. It's on Animal Planet.
Okay, because I know The Haunted from Netflix.
Not that one.
Got it.
It doesn't say this in any of the title cards, but on the show's page, it says it's called The Haunted : Death Rising.
Oh.
But it's just called The Haunted on all the title cards.
Sure.
So, like I said, I was like, there's probably going to be some confusion, but not that show. Overall, I very much enjoyed it.
Love it.
It was barely any reenactments and like all interviews, which is what I'm here for. Oh,
same.
And it's animal themed, so.
I love it.
I'm excited. One more source that I use a little bit of is thecut.com. And now on to our story. Now, I'm not sure when exactly this story takes place because they don't say it in the show at all. But from the little bit of research that I did, I would say sometime between 2000 and 2009 when the show premiered.
Okay. Early aughts.
Early aughts. I went a little crazy and I found one of the people's voter records from the town, like when they registered to vote in the town, which was 2000. And then I was like, Amy, you're like so crazy. You need to relax. Right
love
now.
You so fucking much. And I love that you make me feel less fucking nuts. Like, I wouldn't share this that kind of information with other people because they'd be like, you're fucking crazy.
I know.
So like,
when I did
love
it, I was
so
like, Monique will appreciate this. But I also am like, oh my God, you're so psycho. But I know no. Monique is this level of psycho with me.
One of us. I love it.
So, Mapledale Farm is located in the small community of Barkin Hampstead in the northwestern part of Connecticut. When Donna Santos came across the property, she thought it was the perfect place to move with her family. As soon as she saw the big farmhouse and the land, she fell in love with it. It had room for their dogs, a barn for the horses, and enough space for everyone. Donna was ecstatic and couldn't wait to move up there. But her husband Bob was a little nervous about it. The house was really big, and it was a lot more land than they were used to. Bob said when he saw a picture of it online, he kind of shied away from it. But as soon as they visited the property, Bob and Donna both took to the house right away and fell in love with it. In addition to Bob and Donna, their daughter Carrie, her husband, and Carrie's two kids moved into the property together. They were a family of animal lovers. They always had pets and were the type to happily rescue any animal in need. Carrie said, it's normal to have Noah's Ark in their house. And Donna admitted that she had a tendency to collect animals. She doesn't mean to, but believes that's part of her purpose in life. She's taken in everything from the usual dogs, cats, and horses to a baby turtle and a squirrel.
Aw.
I know. I was like, Donna, I'm with you right there. Like, we are the same.
Clearly. I love it.
If I had room to do that, I fucking would. I would have everything.
I love it.
When they first moved to the property, Donna said she thought the house looked lonely, like it needed somebody to fill it up. But after they began experiencing strange things, she began to believe it wasn't as empty as they originally thought. It just started with little things. They would occasionally smell pipe smoke in the house, as if someone was sitting right next to you smoking, even though no one in the family smoked and they were alone in the house. Donna said she heard footsteps running through a wall and admits that, quote, didn't make sense, end quote. Although Donna and Carrie seemed open to a paranormal explanation, Bob had never been a believer in those things. He worked at an aerospace company and prides himself on being a logical person who believes there's a rational, scientific explanation for everything. When Carrie and Donna told him about the strange things they'd heard and smelled, he would justify it and find some reason to explain why they were experiencing what they were experiencing. He just blamed the noises and smell on it being an old house. But it wasn't long before the animals seemed to be affected by things in the house. The family had two cats, Micah and Mitzi. Donna said Mitzi was always kind of flaky and flighty, but as soon as they moved in, Mitzi ran up into the attic and wouldn't come down. She thought that maybe it was just because of the new surroundings, but whatever the reason, it was clear to Donna that Mitzi felt it was necessary to hide. Mitzi was so adamant about refusing to leave the attic that they started having to put her food and water up there just to get her to eat and drink.
Oh my God.
I know, right? Red fucking flag.
Absolutely.
I'd be like, maybe I want to stay in the attic with the cat, actually. Thanks.
Yeah.
Even though it seemed as though Mitzi had a complete personality change, Donna just thought, well, if that's where she's happy, she's more than welcome to stay up there. And they made sure to keep the door to the attic open in case she ever felt like coming out. But she never did. One night, Donna was home alone. Bob was on a business trip, and Carrie and her family were at a friend's house. She got up in the middle of the night and noticed that the cat's water dish had been moved up two steps. She knew that she was alone in the house at the time, and since she was the one who'd put the bowl out, she was sure the kids hadn't done it. When she mentioned it to Carrie, Carrie thought it was strange, but just chalked it up to her mom messing around. But it continued to happen. They would put the water dish out, and when they came back later, it had very clearly been moved. Always, only up two steps. Once it had happened a few times, it started to get creepy. Carrie said she could tell by her mom's face when she saw that it moved that she thought it was someone else in the house doing it. Donna repeatedly told them to stop moving it, but everyone insisted that they hadn't touched it. Carrie said nobody was moving it. It just got moved. Donna considered that maybe the cat was responsible, but none of the water was ever spilled, so there was no way it was Mitzi. And yet, the bowl would be moved up two steps every single night.
I would fucking put a camera on that shit.
Right?
I would fucking Paranormal Activity that shit.
Seriously.
Like, what the fuck?
I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
As it continued, Donna began to suspect there was something more going on than could be explained logically and started to wonder if she was losing her mind. Mitzi eventually passed away, and according to Donna, the day she died, the water dish stopped moving. She put the dish in the attic for the longest time, waiting to see if something happened, but nothing ever did. After that, Donna brushed off the strange occurrences and just focused on fixing up her new home. But when their dog Vera started acting strangely too, things became harder to ignore. Vera was a Rottweiler that the family had rescued. Carrie described her as a totally normal dog. She said you could play fetch with her, roughhouse with her, and that she'd take your hand in her mouth to lead you to something that she wanted.
Aww.
But the family began to notice that Vera would look in the corner and seemingly watch something cross the room. Although there didn't appear to be anything where she was looking, and they thought it was odd, the family just chalked it up to there being a mouse in the wall or something. Then, one day, Vera was lying in the kitchen by the fireplace when she suddenly jumped up. It looked as though she was tracking something in the room. She followed it across the wall, around the corner, and through the living room. She followed whatever it was to the dining room door, which was closed, and just stopped. She was quivering all over, and her ears were perked up, but she just stood there. Donna opened the door for her, but the dog refused to go into the dining room. She didn't know what Vera had seen, but knew that the dog was clearly convinced there was something there. According to Donna, Vera's behavior didn't make sense. She was a smart dog. She had never acted like that before. And Donna started to think there was something else going on and wondered what could be making her act like this. Carrie said there were times when she'd open the door to toss Vera a treat, but she'd just give her a look, like, don't come any further. Vera would be growling, curling her lips, and showing her teeth, and it got to the point where it felt dangerous. At one point, Vera even ran towards the wall after something when there was nothing visibly there, and she was so intent on whatever it was that she couldn't stop and literally put her nose through the wall.
Holy shit.
Which is a level I don't think I've ever seen in an animal.
No, me neither, for sure.
Worried about the dog's well-being and the family's safety, Donna found Vera a new home. Once she was off the property, Vera's strange behavior stopped immediately. Very quickly, Donna went from being happy and loving her new home to, quote, something's going on here, and I don't know what it is, end quote. Carrie said it was very scary knowing there was some sort of activity going on that the animals were responding to, but that they couldn't see. Bob, of course, was still skeptical. He brushed off the animal's strange behavior and didn't believe there was anything unexplainable going on. Especially since, with the animals now out of the house, nothing strange seemed to be happening anymore. Donna began filling the barn on the property, taking in horses that had been neglected or abandoned or abused. With land to roam on and a loving home, the horses seemed happy. But 3 or 4 months later, the horses started to act strangely as well. Donna said every one of them was, quote, behaving spooky, end quote.
What does that mean?
I feel like it kind of means they were acting spooked is probably spooked, what she meant.
Okay.
Where they're like very nervous and you can tell they're like agitated and they're kind of like stomping their hooves and they do that thing where they like toss their head.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That was her direct quote. And part of me loved it so much. I was like, I have to keep this in here.
Yeah, of course.
They're behaving spooky.
Boom.
One morning when she went up to the barn to feed them, she noticed they weren't in their own stalls. And it appeared as though someone had switched them around in the middle of the night. She just assumed that she'd been in a hurry the night before and hadn't been paying attention when she'd put them up and must have just put them in the wrong stalls. When it happened again, though, she started to think there was something strange going on.
What the fuck?
Right? It was very disconcerting because she says she's always very vigilant about putting them in their proper stalls, especially after the first time. And she always makes sure the stall doors are locked. The doors actually have 2 bolts and a chain with a snap on it, so it's not possible for them to get out without someone's help. But sure enough, when she'd come in the mornings, the horses would be in opposite stalls with the doors shut and locked again. Even Bob thought this was strange. According to him, the horses are very methodical when they come in. They know what stall to go into, and they didn't have to lead them there. So the fact that they were in the wrong stalls was odd, to say the least. He agreed it was hard to understand how that could happen, and looking for a logical explanation, the family started to think that someone must be going into the barn and moving them around at night because it was happening almost every day.
Oh my God.
This would freak me out, which like,
yeah,
this is not a quiet endeavor to like unhook all the stalls and open the doors and move the horses around. Like in the show, like they obviously show footage of the farm. It seems like they have like minimum 4 horses. Like that's a lot to be just like shuffling around here.
Yeah. Like, cause best case scenario, someone is doing this.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily encouraging.
No.
You're like, why the fuck are you doing this? Leave my fucking horses alone.
Yes.
Why are you on my property?
If it's a prank, like, it's a weird prank. Like, why?
Yeah.
What are you accomplishing? You're just kind of, like, creeping everyone out. There's no point to this. If you were going to steal the horse, steal the horse. Don't just, like, move them around.
Yeah.
Who would spend this much time and energy to do this just to be like, ooh, I'm going to make them think they're going crazy and creep them out? Like,
right.
Weird. Again, though, I paranormal activity this shit. Like, I would have 17 cameras set up in this goddamn barn. I was like, I don't care what it costs.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
That being said, housing animals, especially horses, is very expensive. So if you weren't willing to drop money on some extra camera equipment, like, I can kind of understand that. I get it.
Yeah, for sure.
Since Donna's friend Laura was boarding her horse at the Santos barn, they asked her if maybe she had been moving them around. But she said she hadn't. Not only was there no point in doing that, but she commented that horses can get seriously injured, even when they're in their stalls. So to have them moving around loose in the barn, where there are pitchforks and tools around, is just asking for trouble. Donna was especially concerned because one of the horses they had rescued was blind, and she was afraid that he'd hurt himself being in a situation and a stall he wasn't familiar with. Bob was worried that if there was someone getting into the barn, there could very well be an accident or a fire as a result, and they'd never be able to get there in time. Determined to figure out if someone was getting into the barn, Donna put a piece of tape on the door, thinking if anyone opened it, the tape would be moved. But the tape was always right where she had placed it. Then she put a thread across the only window that opened in the barn. So if someone opened it to climb in and out, they wouldn't see it and would break the thread. But again, the thread was exactly as she'd left it and still intact. Nothing they tried proved that someone was getting into the barn.
Priest party this shit.
Right?
Like, right meow. Like, yesterday. What the fuck are you doing?
Seriously. I would, like, start feeding the horses sage or some shit. I'm like, you get, like, something.
Absolutely.
Something's going on here.
Girl.
Get a coconut. Probably absolutely not the easiest thing in Connecticut, but like, I don't know. Just saying.
They gotta have a Whole Foods in Connecticut. I'm sure they have that shit there, right?
Ask around. You never know.
Girl.
Nothing they tried proved that someone was getting into the barn. But after several weeks of the horses repeatedly ending up in the wrong stalls, they were convinced they must have an intruder on the property. Not knowing what else to do, Donna called the police. In response, officers came out and watched the barn all night. They never saw anyone around the barn, let alone enter it. But sure enough, that morning, when Donna went to check on the horses, they were once again in the wrong stalls with the doors latched, chained, and locked. The police didn't know what to do or what to think. They thought maybe someone had climbed in a window in the back of the barn out of their line of sight. But according to Donna, there are 500 acres of woods behind the barn, and there's no way someone could have walked through them at night undetected. The cops didn't know what to tell the Santos family. They told them that they'd been there all night and hadn't seen anyone. None of the lights in the barn had been turned on, and they hadn't seen anyone moving around. Carrie said it was really creepy. And after that, they knew it wasn't a matter of a person being in the barn, that there was something more to it. There was no explanation for how the horses got moved around. They can't just jump the stall walls. They can't unlock the latches. It just doesn't happen. Then Donna said they started to hear footsteps running across the hayloft while they were in the barn. When they go up to check, thinking maybe a chicken got up there, there was nothing, and it was always empty. With all that had been happening, Donna started to think that it probably wasn't people at all. It just didn't make sense. If it had been a person, they would have found some evidence of them by then.
Sure.
But there was nothing. One night, Donna went up to feed the horses. It was wintertime, so it was already dark and cold out. When she got to the barn, it was clear that the horses were upset. Every one of them was dripping in sweat, and they were pacing in their stalls, clearly uneasy. She knew that something must have spooked them. She searched everywhere for what could have gotten them so worked up, maybe a wild animal or something, but there was nothing in the barn that she could see. They all clearly wanted to go outside and get away from whatever it was they were sensing in the barn. She couldn't think of a logical reason for them to be this upset, but wanting to calm them down, she went up to the hayloft to get a couple bales of hay. When she looked into the darkness on the right-hand side of the loft, she saw something separate from the shadows. Whatever it was about 5 feet tall and started moving across the hayloft.
What the fuck?
I know. I don't want to burn the barn down because, like, obviously it's the horse's home, but, like...
It's their house, yeah. But burn it down.
But burn it down, yeah. Take the horses somewhere else. I don't know what to tell you. No. It was shuffling, almost like it was dragging itself. Its arms were hanging down like it was stooped over. Donna said it walked till it got to the center of the loft. Then it slowed down, turned, and looked right at her.
Oh, my God.
Although she couldn't see its face, she could see its eyes, and they were glowing red. All the hair stood up on her arms and the back of her neck. Her heart stopped, and she felt like she couldn't breathe. But she knew she just had to get out of there. When she got back to the house, Bob said it was clear that she was scared to death by what she'd seen and refused to go up in the hayloft alone after that. Because he'd never had that kind of experience himself, he couldn't really relate, which caused some tension between the two of them. Donna said, quote, "I know something was there, and it truly scared me," end quote. Now, it's commonly believed that animals are more sensitive to spirits than humans, and the behavior of Donna's cat, dog, and horses seems to support that theory. While there is no definitive scientific evidence to prove that animals can in fact see ghosts, Catherine Bosey, an animal communicator who lives in British Columbia, is one of the many people who believes they can, because they're not culturally conditioned to dismiss these moments as pure imagination.
That makes sense.
Which I thought was very interesting. I somehow never thought of that aspect of it. I was always just like, they have better senses than us, so they can see and hear things we can't.
Right. Yeah. They don't have like their horse mom being like, you're dumb and that's not happening.
Go to sleep. There's nothing there. What's wrong with you? You're making it up.
There are no monsters under your horse bed, horse.
Yeah, horses aren't gaslighting one another. She says horses in particular are sensitive where spirits are concerned because of the fact that they're herd animals. So their bonds are very strong and they're very emotional. but the dogs and cats can as well. Jackson Galaxy, a cat behavior and wellness expert and the host of Animal Planet's My Cat from Hell, said, quote,
is that his real name?
That's what it was in the article I read.
I'm sorry. We need to put a quick little pause in this so I can Wikipedia this because there's no way.
I mean, it sounds fake as fuck. Let's be real.
No, Richard Kirshner. Duh. Okay. I just needed, I'm sorry. I didn't want to like poo-poo that, but I was like, there's no fucking way that there's a.
Yeah.
Mr. and Mrs. Galaxy, we have to talk about your son Jackson at the PTA meeting. Like, that's not fucking happening. I'm sorry. I just needed to confirm that for myself.
I mean, you know, that's fair. I am engaged to Johnny Begood, so, like, I have a higher tolerance for unbelievable names than most people, I feel like. But that one's – the bullshit meter goes off with that.
It's a bridge too far. I feel like Jackson Galaxy is the guy who, like, jilted Miss Frizzle at the altar.
Oh, my God. I love you so much. Yes. Yes. I was going to say that or, like, something out of, like, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something. Like, I don't know. Douglas Adams was more clever than that, though. Let's be real.
Yeah, and that she, like, spends her fucking time in a magic school bus going through the galaxy to be, like, you know, Mrs. Havishamming this shit, being like, where, you know, this is where he fucking proposed, this motherfucker. Oh, yeah, that's Saturn and it's rings. Whatever.
Like this ring I got from Mr. Galaxy. Heyo.
Did I give it back? No, I didn't. Fuck him. Someone make that show. I would watch the fuck out of that show.
Oh, my God, saying. In a heartbeat. I love you so much. I like don't, I love you. I always say it multiple times every episode, but just like, you're wonderful.
Likewise, my love.
All right. Richard Kushner, whatever the fuck his name is, aka
Jackson Galaxy.
Jackson Galaxy said, quote, from just a purely evolutionary standpoint, cats have evolved to sense things that we as humans can't. Their eyes can see perfectly with the smallest bit of light. They can hear 6 to 8 times better than we can. And their whiskers are designed to detect everything from temperature changes to air current changes, end quote.
Oh, shit. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
Cats are amazing.
Which dogs are amazing, too. All of this pretty much goes for dogs as well.
Yeah. Animals are amazing.
Animals are great. We don't deserve them.
No.
They're phenomenal.
Yes.
Every time I watch a nature show, which I have been doing a little bit of recently, Predators on Netflix, narrated by Tom Hardy, actually great.
Oh.
Even though he says puma very weirdly.
How does he say puma?
Puma?
Oh, yeah. That seems like a Hardyism.
I don't know if that's a British thing or like.
I think it might be a Tom Hardy thing.
I don't know. It's weird, but also it makes me chuckle and I'm kind of here for it. Every time I watch a nature show and I see how other animals have to live their lives and that it's just like you have to murder something for food. You're constantly in danger. You might be murdered for food. I couldn't do any of that.
Yeah. So, like, you might get murdered taking a cat nap.
Yeah. Going for a drink at the watering hole. A fucking alligator might eat your goddamn face. Yeah.
Yeah, girl.
Hard pass. No, thank you. So, were the Santos's animals sensing something or someone that they, as humans, couldn't see? Well, Donna was definitely more open than Bob was to the possibility that something paranormal was going on. And she was starting to think that it wasn't just the house that was haunted, but the barn as well. She was worried that whatever it was something that could harm the animals. She had no way of knowing what was going on in the barn when they weren't there, and wondered if whatever she saw in the hayloft was the reason the horses seemed agitated sometimes when she went to let them out in the mornings.
Donna, survey says, yes, it is. It is that.
Yes.
It is that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hate to break it to you, girl, but yes.
I know. She said it was terrifying because, quote, you can't control something you don't understand, end quote. After that, things started to escalate. One night, while Donna and her friend Laura were in the barn cleaning out the stalls and doing the chores, Laura suddenly said she smelled smoke, and Donna agreed. Because Laura had previously driven a truck for the fire department, she was well-versed in what to do when you think you're having a fire. Laura proceeded to check every nook and cranny to locate the source of the smoke, but found nothing. They checked outside, thinking maybe someone was barbecuing or had a bonfire going, but there was no smell out there. It was only in the barn. Laura said what scared her the most was that she saw what looked like a haze in the barn. So she kept searching, trying to find the source of the smoke, and when she couldn't, she really started to panic, and the two decided to call the fire department. James Legacy, the Barkhamsted fire chief, was one of the firefighters who responded that night. He had been there once before for a garage fire a few years back, so when the call came in, he knew there was a good possibility that it could be a real fire. Two fire trucks arrived on site, and after talking to Donna and Laura, James immediately brought out a smoke sniffer, a device that detects particles of combustion to locate the source of the fire or pre-fire event. Like a Geiger counter, the smoke sniffer uses auditory and visual indicators to direct firefighters to the source of the fire. By the way, cutest name for a firefighting device I've ever heard in my life.
Yes.
It's the smoke sniffer.
See, I would think that that was like an aardvark or something. Like, you know, it's yes. Like, you know, like something like super cute. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And it'd be like a children's book. It's like, like Sally the smoke sniffing aardvark or some shit. I don't know.
You are knocking it out of the park with creative ideas today.
Girl, like, I don't know.
Write this shit down. You know, somebody fucking do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I slept a fair amount last night. I think that might have something to do with it. And your brain working, full night's sleep, who knew?
It's good for that.
You know, that's what they tell me.
It's shocking when it happens. James proceeded to search the perimeter and shut off the power to the barn just in case. They checked the electrical and any place there could be heat sources. They inspected the entire barn. They scanned the walls and the ceiling downstairs, then went up to the hayloft and checked the floor up there, as well as the roof of the barn. They went outside the barn and scanned the exterior wall, but found nothing. However, both James and the other firefighter who was assisting with the inspection agreed that they could smell the slight smell of lingering smoke, but again, couldn't find any evidence of a fire. After that, Donna was convinced that whatever was in the barn was something paranormal and knew it was time to look into the history of the house.
Wait, now she's doing this. Girl, that's day one. I'm sorry.
I feel like once I saw the thing in the hayloft, I would have.
Yes.
I would have started.
Give it a quick goog.
But you know what? I might have been on the sea of denial and just been like,
row, row, row your boat, bitch.
Nope.
You know,
my eyes are playing tricks on me. I'm kind of freaked out. Maybe there was like an owl and some shadows and something. I don't know. Let's not ask any more questions. Sort of vibe. I don't know.
I guess.
Monique loves her research. She would have been doing research from day one.
Yeah, it's like fucked up. I do. Yeah. I love a deep dive on anything.
I love this about you. But Donna's finally getting with the program. And she's doing her research. In town, she found a book on the history of Barkhamsted and discovered that the original barn on the property had burned down in 1923. There was still evidence of the old foundation, and she said they would find pieces of charred wood when the horses dug up the land. She couldn't find out if anyone or any animals were killed in the fire, but wondered if maybe whatever she'd seen in the hayloft had been a casualty of the blaze. Donna said she was at her wit's end and just didn't know where to go from there. Carrie was terrified, and both her and Donna were worried about the children. They didn't want them terrified to go to bed at night, but they didn't know how to help. Donna finally decided to call a paranormal investigator to try to find out what the fuck was going on. She reached out to John Zontik, the leader of the Northwest Connecticut Paranormal Society, who had been investigating unexplained hauntings for the past 10 years. His group has done over 200 residential investigations, and John said of those, about 8% had resulted in things they just couldn't explain. Which I feel like for a paranormal investigator is a very reasonable percentage.
Yeah, I think so.
After hearing Donna's story, John agreed to come out to the farm with his team to see what they could find. They performed an 8-hour investigation that included 4 infrared cameras with night vision, 2 in the hayloft and 2 downstairs with the horses. While most of the team remained outside of the barn, Amanda, one of the investigators, and John's daughter stayed inside to run an EVP session by herself. She said when she walked into the barn for the first time, it felt very strange. She felt an immediate heaviness, like something just wasn't right, and it seemed like the animals felt the same way. During her session, she heard the same footsteps in the hayloft that Donna had reported, and when she went upstairs to investigate, she saw something in the back corner that looked like a shadow. But when it immediately disappeared, she thought maybe her eyes were just playing tricks on her. All of a sudden, she heard a loud bang downstairs. Then she could hear the horses bumping against the walls of their stalls, spinning around and shaking their heads, acting completely different than they had been before. When she went back downstairs, out of the corner of her eye, she saw something move past the window. She said it didn't really have any detail to it. There was no color or anything. It just looked like a shadow went by. And as soon as it did, Amanda said the horses started freaking out. She thought maybe it had been her dad or another one of the investigators walking by. But when she went outside to look around the barn, there was no one there. And it was pitch black out. So she decided to go back to the hayloft and start asking questions. As soon as she did, the horses once again started banging against their stalls. So she asked, "Did you just scare the horses?" Seconds later, she recorded an EVP that seems to say, quote, "Don't be scared," end quote.
Oh.
Yeah, which, okay, but I am.
I mean, you did nail it, because we are.
Yeah, because I'm terrified. You're banging around and freaking all the animals out, bro. I will say the, like, investigators are like, it's a crystal clear recording. And it's like, I can hear the don't be part really clear, but, like, the scared part. If you hadn't told me what they said, I would sure. be like, what? Subtitles? Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the tricky thing with those.
I know.
You can kind of, like, impose whatever it whatever is you want it to say.
Yes. Yes. Immediately, Amanda felt like she didn't belong there. Freaked out, she left the barn to tell the others what had happened. The team then returned to the barn with her to continue the investigation. They reportedly recorded several more EVP over the course of the night. One seems to say sorry, while another whispers, "Here I am." After completing their investigation, John said, quote, "So many people here experience things, including things that we picked up on our audio and video. It makes me believe that there is a haunting," end quote. When Bob Santos listened to the recordings, the skeptic of the family said, quote, "From what I heard, it was just incredible," end quote. For Donna, they confirmed what she already believed to be true. She said, quote, "There's definitely somebody there, and they want us to know that they're there because they have no problem speaking out," end quote. She is now convinced that there is at least one, but possibly more than one, active spirit residing in the barn. But she wasn't content with just knowing that they were there. She wanted to know who they were and why they were still there. So John encouraged her to continue to research the property, looking for any deaths that had occurred on the premises. There were records of the land dating back to 1760. Soldiers were housed on the property at one point, and obviously a lot of farming was done there. So it's reasonable to assume there have been quite a few deaths there, human or otherwise. Donna was able to discover that a farmer had died there at one point, so she started asking around about it. She was told that the man was forced off his land so the town could put in a reservoir and was relocated against his will to what was now Donna's farm, where he lived there alone, taking care of the animals. Unfortunately, not long after he got settled in, he got sick and died. The locals said he had a form of skin cancer that had eaten away parts of his face.
Oh.
And that by the time he died, he was barely recognizable. I know.
That's terrible.
Terrible.
If it is him, I can understand, like, him just showing up like that way, and then people freaking out and him being like, "Don't be afraid, I'm sorry. I'm nice."
It kind of makes sense. He also probably, like, he's like still doing farm work. He's moving the horses around. He's like up in the hayloft.
Yeah.
Moving bales and stuff.
Yeah. That makes sense.
That seems like a terrifying ghost to see, though. If, absolutely. Like, that's your final look, your ghost look. Like,
yeah.
I don't want that to be my ghost look.
No, I don't think anyone does.
Like, do a rewind until before the skin cancer and let me have, like, a cute ghost experience, please.
I mean, very suboptimal.
Yes. Because of his history taking care of the animals by himself, Donna believes that he's the spirit that resides in the barn and has been moving the horses, and that he is the one who they recorded the EVPs of. Still wanting answers, the Santos decided to conduct their own EVP session. Bob, Carrie, and Donna all went up into the hayloft with the recorder. Carrie said as soon as they got up there, there was a density to the air, and it felt darker than it should be, even with all the lights on. Donna asked the spirit to please give them a sign. Seconds later, something clattered downstairs. Bob immediately said he was done. He was like, "I'm done. Yeah, yes. I'm gone. Yeah."
Yeah.
While Carrie immediately accused him of doing it. Bob denied it, and they all insisted it wasn't them. Carrie said it sounded like something had been thrown across the barn, that it had bounced off the roof and down to the floor, then ricocheted. Bob said it wasn't as though someone just threw a rock, it hit the wall, and dropped. It was three distinct tones hitting multiple spots in the barn. It wasn't thrown at them, just in a direction close to where they were. But it was close enough and loud enough that it immediately made all three of them want to get the fuck out of there. Bob said, quote, "That scared me. That really did. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't something somebody might have done just to get a reaction. I just couldn't get an explanation for it." End quote. Before they left the barn, though, Donna went toward the sound to see what she could find and came across a piece of slag rock. It was the only thing they found on the floor, and she knew that it must have been what they heard. Carrie said, quote, "There was without a doubt something completely unexplainable." End quote. She realized they were dealing with something much bigger than they could comprehend, something they just couldn't justify. She said, quote, "There's no way that a piece of slag would get thrown across the loft by anything." End quote. Once the skeptic of the family, Bob says he now believes that there are spirits residing on the property after what they experienced. He was the last holdout of the family, and Donna was relieved when he admitted it. She felt like he finally believed her, and she had proof that she wasn't going crazy. But with the presence in the barn basically confirmed, Donna worried for the welfare of the animals and called John to see what could be done. He agreed to come out again, this time with an intuitive named Tracy Shannon, who often works with animals. Tracy said the first thing she noticed when she walked into the barn, even before the horses, was the heaviness in the air, because the energy was so intense. She immediately picked up on the presence of a man in the corner of the stall she and Amanda were in. Amanda had a K2 meter with her, and according to John, it went to the max immediately, which he claims never happens. After only a few minutes, Tracy asked Donna to step outside with her and confirmed that there was definitely something going on in the barn. She said that she could sense more than one spirit there and that they were attached to not only the property, but to Donna herself now. Tracy told her they needed to help them move on and that they wanted Donna to be the person to help them do it. She immediately agreed and asked Tracy what she needed to do. Tracy told her she needed to ground herself for protection, to call on the light to help the spirits find their way, and to specifically visualize the spirit she thought was haunting the barn. As Tracy was going over the process with Donna, she said she could see a spirit and that it looked as though he had been very ill. Tracy did a ritual to help the spirits pass on. After, she said the light came in and she could feel the energy start to lift. As it did, she could feel him cross over, and after that, it felt so much lighter in the barn, and the presence was gone. Donna said with Tracy's guidance, they helped a number of spirits cross over, releasing the negative energy on the property. Afterwards, the horses seemed calmer, and Donna said it doesn't feel as dark in the barn anymore. She was relieved that she was able to finally help the horses get some peace, as well as the spirits. She doesn't believe that they were ever malicious. They just wanted her to know they were there. 4 months later, and it seems like all the strange occurrences are a thing of the past. Donna said, as soon as they started acknowledging that the spirits were there, things calmed down a lot. It was much quieter in the barn, and the horses seemed more peaceful than they were before. And that is the story of the haunting of the Santos family at Mapledale Farm.
That is crazy.
It was wild.
Again, it's one of those things that I could think a thing and I could ignore it, but when all these animals are like not here for it, there's something wrong.
Yes. That is like the biggest red flag to me.
Absolutely.
But I like really enjoyed the show. I'm going to be honest. For a paranormal show, like, there's not that many reenactments, so you don't get, like, the cheesy aspect of it. It's a lot of B-roll of dogs and horses and cats, lots of animals.
That's amazing.
And I really appreciated that they interviewed a lot of people in this story. Like, yeah. I feel like with a lot of these shows, you get, like, two people from the family and that's it. Like,
sure.
8 people total were interviewed for this
oh,
show.
Oh, wow, okay.
Including, like, the firefighters and shit. So, pretty good.
Traditionally credible people. Yeah.
Yeah. One weird thing I did stumble on in my like trying to figure out the date that this took place. It seems as though the Santos now live in Lake City, Florida.
Oh.
Which is like 30 minutes from like the little town I grew up in.
Yeah.
Like, that was the biggest, quote unquote, like, city that we were near. So, like, anytime we went to the movies, because Live Oak didn't have a movie theater, we would drive to Lake City and a mall. Like, that's where the mall was.
Girl.
Kind of weirded me out. I'm not going to lie. I was like, what the fuck? So, yeah. Animals and ghosts. Two of my favorite things.
I love that. I love that story. It was definitely creepy.
It was very creepy.
But I hate if it's him and he's just like looks fucked up because he had cancer and is inadvertently scaring everyone. That makes me very sad.
Me too.
When all he wants to do is just hang out with horses and hoe.
Yeah.
You know, who among us, right?
He's just trying to help out. There's a lot of chores on a farm. He's like, oh, girl, you know, take something off your plate. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you'd think anyone would appreciate that living on a farm for sure.
But not if they're scaring the animals.
Yeah, no.
And like, I get it. You're smelling the smoke. There's like a weird thing you can't explain. I would be worried that it would burn the barn down with the horses inside.
10,000%.
And then you wouldn't be able to get to them in time. Like, that would have been my biggest fear too.
Yeah, for sure.
On that note, do you have a traumatizing true crime story for us? Did you
do
it?
I think it's traumatizing.
Okay. Yay.
Because I had chosen this before you did last week. So I was like, well, I'm ready doing this. So
I love it.
No, I love this story because it's wild. So I don't think it's really traumatizing. So sources, cfjctoday.com, Wikipedia, allthat'sinteresting.com, newenglandhistoricalsociety.com, slate.com, snopes.com, and npr.org.
Ooh, I love me some NPR.
Girl, same. On December 8th, 1976, a Universal Studios production crew arrived at the New Pike Amusement Park in Long Beach, California, to film an episode of The $6 Million Man. For those who don't know, The $6 Million Man is an American sci-fi action series that ran from 1973 to 1978. About a former astronaut named USAF Colonel Steve Austin, played by Lee Majors. After Steve Austin is severely injured in a NASA test flight accident, Austin is rebuilt with robotic implants to make him superhuman. His right arm, both legs, and left eye are replaced with bionic implants to enhance his strength, speed, and vision far above human norms. He can run at speeds of over 60 miles an hour, and his eye has 20-to-1 zoom lens and infrared capabilities, and his bionic limbs all have the equivalent power of a bulldozer. This mechanical glow-up operation cost the government $6 million, or the equivalent of $41.6 million today. But, you know, not as fancy, hence the title of the show. The $41.6 million man. It doesn't have the same ring.
It doesn't, yeah, roll off the tongue.
No. Austin is then employed as a secret agent by the fictional U.S. government office, OSI, or Office of Scientific Intelligence. On this December day, crew members were preparing to shoot a scene on location at Pike Amusement Park for an upcoming episode of the action series titled Carnival of Spies. Fun little side fact in my Googling, while I keep referring to the amusement park as Pike Amusement Park, the carnival actually changed its name in 1969 to Queen's Park after the theme park purchased the Queen Mary as a combination tourist attraction and hotel. However, as is usually the case, most locals continue to call the amusement park the Pike.
Was the Queen Mary the one that was haunted too? Am I misremembering?
Yes. Even though Pike Amusement Park doesn't exist anymore, the Queen Mary is still there and you can still, I believe you can even stay in there as a, like in the hotel, and you could do tours, and you could definitely do ghost tours, at least in October. I don't know if it's all the time, but definitely in October.
Okay.
You're thinking of the correct place.
Yay.
So this particular scene was going to be shot in one of the amusement park's haunted house rides, Laugh in the Dark. The spooky ride featured a tunnel in which ghouls, demons, and skeletons would pop out and scare you as your car jolted from side to side in the dark. The setup for the scene was to capture the $6 million man himself riding in one of these cars through the creepy attraction. So, as per usual, the crew were busy at work on set, adding lights and set dressing and equipment and moving whatever necessary to make room to work or frame the shot. While preparing the set, a props man decided that the wax mannequin painted Dayglow orange hanging from a noose in the corner wasn't going to work for their scene. So the crew man grabbed the mannequin's arm to pull the figure down, but ended up ripping the limb right off. Whoops. And everyone on set had a good laugh. Until the crew member looked at the dummy arm in his hand. And upon closer inspection, he saw that the dismembered limb wasn't made of wax or papier-mâché or plastic as he had originally thought, but that it appeared to be, beneath layers of dried, mummified skin, a human bone.
No.
Yes.
Right out of the fucking gate. Are you serious?
Girl. Yeah.
And I quit. That's my last day on the job. Thanks so much for the trauma. I'll bill you.
Yeah, right? The police were called and the body was taken to the Los Angeles coroner's office. On December 9th, Dr. Joseph Choi conducted an autopsy and determined that the 5'2" body was that of a human male who had died of a gunshot wound to the chest. The body weighed approximately 50 pounds and was completely petrified, covered in wax, as well as layers of phosphorus paint. Some hair was still visible on the sides and back of the head, while the ears, big toes, and fingers were all missing.
Oh! Oh, no.
This is a wild ride. We're, like, buckling up. We're in the amusement park.
Literally. It's a wild ride.
The coroner found scars and bunions, as well as tuberculosis in the lung of the deceased. Tests conducted on the body's tissue showed the presence of arsenic. And while you might be like, oh shit, arsenic poisoning, arsenic, turns out, I found out, was a key component of embalming fluid in the early 1900s. The coroner's examination also curiously revealed what appeared to be incisions from an original autopsy and embalming. While the bullet that caused the fatal wound was presumably removed during the original autopsy, the bullet jacket was found and upon further examination was determined to be a gas check jacket, which were used from 1905 until 1940. When the coroner removed the deceased's lower jaw for dental analysis, Dr. Choi found ticket stubs to Louis Sunny's Museum of Crime, as well as a corroded penny from 1924 in the corpse's mouth.
What?
Girl.
I know that's like a burial ritual to the coin in the mouth, so you can pay the ferryman of the River Styx.
That's not what this is. There is that of leaving for the ferryman, but I only know it to be on the eyes. I've never heard it in the mouth.
So I feel like I had to read or had to. I was such a nerd that I read the Iliad and the Odyssey for school on my own free time. I don't know. And in that.
Oh, is it in the mouth?
It's in the mouth.
Oh, okay.
I feel like it's very much portrayed in pop culture, though, as the,
yes,
eyes. I don't know if historically it's both of those things, but I do know that they did it in the mouth. Because if you're like spirit, you know, sat up or whatever, they would just fall off of your eyes.
Sure, yeah.
And then you wouldn't have any way to carry them to the ferryman. Whereas if it's in your mouth, then when you got there, you would be like, oh, shit, it's on my tongue. Here you go. Do you
that
have change? Like,
oddly, yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening here, though. But I love that. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
I love
Thank
that.
You for already knowing that because you're amazing.
You're amazing. I love you. After much investigating and with the help of historians and forensic anthropologists, the LA coroner's office finally had a name for their body. Elmer McCurdy. Elmer McCurdy was born on January 1st, 1880, in Washington, Maine, to a 17-year-old unwed mother named Augusta Sadie McCurdy. While the identity of Elmer's father is unknown, some historians speculate it may have been Sadie's older cousin, Charles Smith, which, coincidentally or not, I know. But I know that this was like kind of
it's a thing during
common.
That time. It's, yeah.
Which, coincidentally or not, was a name Elmer would use as an alias later in life. To save Sadie from the shame and stigma of raising an illegitimate child, her brother George and his wife Helen adopted Elmer. After George died of tuberculosis in 1890, Sadie and Helen moved with Elmer to Bangor, Maine, where Sadie eventually told her son the truth about his parentage, which apparently did not go over well. Elmer became, quote, unruly and rebellious, end quote, drinking to the point where he became known as the town drunk when he was still a teenager.
Oof. Not a cute look, Elmer.
Yeah. I mean, it is the late 1800s, so like...
Yeah.
Yeah. I also know that like being a teenager, like you were like a 45-year-old man with like a mortgage and shit.
Like 14, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I've got three kids at home, all right? I need to drink.
Exactly. But McCurdy tried to turn his life around. He moved in with his grandfather and became a plumber. And he was good at it. He made good money and lived comfortably. That is, until the economy took a downturn in 1898. Elmer lost his job, and the following year, his mother died of a ruptured ulcer. 2 months later, his grandfather also passed away. And all of this went down by the time that Elmer was 20 years old. So he's definitely having a rough go of it. McCurdy left Maine and bounced around the eastern U.S. looking for work as a plumber and lead miner. And despite being a talented plumber, McCurdy's alcoholism always got in the way, and he was unable to hold down a steady job. His drinking got so bad that in 1905, while he was living in Iola, Kansas, Elmer was arrested for public intoxication. Determined to get back on the right track, McCurdy joined the U.S. Army in 1907 and was assigned to Fort Leavenworth, where he operated a machine gun and was trained on how to use nitroglycerin for demolition purposes. By all accounts, his training on how to handle the explosives was minimal, which just shouldn't be a thing. But, you know, it's 1907, so safety? I don't know her. What?
They, like, hand you a pamphlet, and they're like, all right, good luck, go out.
I mean, you know, also the fucking literacy rate is non-existent here. So pamphlet, they're like, I don't know what this is.
There you go.
Cool.
But yeah, that seems dangerous.
Yes, because it is. McCurdy served in the Army for 3 years before being honorably discharged on November 7th, 1910. Elmer made his way to St. Joseph, Kansas, where he met up with a friend from the Army. And whatever attempts Elmer had made to go the straight and narrow seemed to go out the window when on November 19th, just 12 days after being discharged from the Army, both McCurdy and his Army buddy were found with chisels, hacksaws, funnels for nitroglycerin, gunpowder, and money sacks. And promptly arrested, girl.
Wonder what they were up to.
Uh-huh. And promptly arrested for possessing burglary paraphernalia.
Also, please tell me these were, like, the comical muddy sacks from, like, cartoons where there's literally, like, the dollar sign painted on the outside.
That's what I decided it was.
Thank you.
I don't know if it was, but I've decided it.
We're on the same page, 100%.
Of course, as always, yes. During their arraignment, McCurdy and his friend told the judge that they weren't trying to rob anyone, but they were working on inventing a foot-operated machine gun.
Of course.
Of course. But you know what? The jury bought it. And in January of 1911, McCurdy and his partner were both found not guilty. They were released from county jail, and Elmer moved to Lenapah, Oklahoma. And it was there that Elmer decided to embark on a life of crime. He decided to become a professional bank robber.
It's a bold choice, but
it is. It is a bold choice. And it's very funny. Like I said, I had already chosen the story
before
you did yours last week. And I was like, well.
Psychic sisters. Yeah, no.
We're going to do this. Great.
No complaints. I will take a bank robbery story any day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, same. Totally. So remember how I mentioned that McCurdy learned how to handle nitroglycerin during his time in the Army? Well, Elmer figured that he would target banks and trains carrying a lot of cash and use his knowledge of explosives to blow open the safe and get the money inside. Easy peasy. McCurdy heard tell that one of the cars on Iron Mountain, Missouri Pacific Train number 104 carried a safe that contained $4,000, which, while the inflation calculator only goes till 1913, and this takes place 2 years before that, $4,000 translates to almost $126,000 in today's money. So McCurdy assembled a crew of three men he had met on his travels And 2 months after he was arrested for possession of burglary paraphernalia, McCurdy and company made the plan to rob Iron Mountain, Missouri Pacific Train number 104. The gang successfully stopped the train and located the safe. Elmer placed the nitroglycerin charge on the safe's door and lit it up. So remember how I also told you that Elmer's explosives training during his time in the Army was minimal at best? When handling something like explosives, it's paramount to use the correct amount. And apparently Elmer was out to lunch during that session because the charge Elmer put on the safe door had way too much nitroglycerin on it.
Oh my God, please don't tell me he just like exploded all the money and then...
As a result, enormous explosion not only destroyed the safe in the blast, but the majority of the money they were hoping to steal.
That's amazing. Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. This whole thing sounds like an Acme cartoon. I swear to God.
I was going
to
say, like, it's such Looney Tunes shit.
Yes. What is going on right now?
Yeah. McCurdy and his partners managed to net $450 in silver coins, most of which, however, were melted and fused to the safe's frame.
That's not sketchy when you go to try to pay for shit. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
And granted, they're trying to steal $4,000. They roll out with $450. It's not great.
No.
But hey, every mistake is a learning opportunity, right? So 6 months later, on September 21st, 1911, McCurdy and two other men attempted to rob the Citizens Bank in Chautauqua, Kansas. After spending 2 hours breaking through the bank wall with a hammer, McCurdy placed a nitroglycerin charge on the door of the bank's outer vault. The blast blew the door through the bank, destroying the interior, but did not damage the safe inside the vault. So, automatically, progress. Elmer then tried to blow open the safe door, but the charge wouldn't light. And remember, while McCurdy was unable to blow open the safe door, he did successfully use the charge on the outer vault door. And explosions are loud as fuck. So not only did their lookout guy freak out and run off, but the blast ended up waking up half of the town. So it was only a matter of moments before the men were discovered.
Oh, so, my God.
Girl. So the crew made out with $150 in coins that were in the tray outside the safe.
They got less than the one they blew up. Yes. The entire safe. Oh, my God. This is like a comedy of errors.
Oh, I'm absolutely.
Like, I'm beaming. This is hysterical. Yes. I'm so here for this.
The men jumped a train and hightailed it out of town to the Kansas border. There, the gang split up. And McCurdy made his way to a friend's ranch near Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where he laid low for the next few weeks, staying in the hayshed and drinking heavily. The thief was down, but he wasn't out. Determined to make his life of crime pay, Elmer caught wind that a Katy train containing $400,000 in cash that was intended as a royalty payment to the Osage Nation was set to roll through town on October 4th. McCurdy assembled a crew with two other men, and on October 4th, Elmer and his two accomplices successfully took control of the train, uncoupled the car from the engine, and left it standing in the tracks. They searched the car, found the safe, opened it, but it was empty. Elmer and co. had hijacked the wrong train.
No. No. I literally can't. What?
Turns out
you're so bad at your job. Girl. Like, why did you pick this as a career? You can't
quit your day job, girl. It is so bad.
I admire the tenacity. I really do.
Same.
Like, if I failed at something twice, fucked it up twice, I wouldn't go back for a third time.
Yeah, yeah. Turns out McCurdy and his accomplices were wrong about the train's departure and arrival times. So instead of robbing the train containing the $400,000, they had mistakenly stopped an earlier passenger train instead. Stealing whatever they could to make it worth their while, the Mr. Magoo crew made out.
That's an amazing nickname for them and very applicable. Yes.
Yes, accurate.
Yes.
They made out with the conductor's watch, a revolver, a coat, 2 jugs of whiskey, and 46 whole dollars. A newspaper account of the robbery later called it, quote, one of the smallest in the history of train robbery, end quote.
And by smallest, I think they meant saddest. This is, I just, yes. I have just been nonstop shaking my head this whole time. I can't.
Now, some historians have suggested that maybe their plan all along was to hijack the earlier passenger train and use the passenger car to block the oncoming express train to get a better haul. However, seeing as the best predictor of the present and future is the past, I think it's safe to say that Elmer McCurdy was just a drunken moron who was really, really bad at this.
Yes. Yeah. Correct. Giving him a lot of credit.
I think so.
That was the plan. No.
Yeah. Because if that was the plan, why didn't they stay for the other train?
Yeah. He would have had the $400,000. No.
Yeah. With little to show for his efforts, on October 6th, the disappointed and dejected McCurdy returned to his friend's ranch, where he proceeded to drink the whiskey he stole.
Yeah, I would have done that too.
In addition to being depressed at being the world's worst bank and train robber. Elmer had tuberculosis, which he had developed from his time working at the mines, as well as a mild case of pneumonia and trichinosis. So Elmer's not doing great. McCurdy stayed up, drowning his sorrows with some of the ranch hands before literally hitting the hay and going to sleep. Unbeknownst to McCurdy, though, one of his accomplices had been captured and ratted out Elmer to the sheriff, and a $2,000 reward was issued for McCurdy's capture.
Yeah, I'm not going down for fucking 2 bottles of whiskey, a coat, and a watch. No.
And a fucking 46 bucks that we split three ways.
No.
In the early morning hours of October 7th, a posse of 3 deputy sheriffs, brothers Bob and Stringer Fenton and Dick Wallace, tracked down McCurdy to the hay shed using bloodhounds. The men surrounded the shed and waited for daylight. Fueled by booze and perhaps anger at his mediocrity, the would-be gangster shot at the lawmen first, and the police shot back. McCurdy refused to be taken alive, and he wasn't. After an hour-long shootout, Elmer McCurdy was pronounced dead on October 7, 1911, killed by a single gunshot wound to the chest, which was sustained while lying down. The outlaw was just 31 years old. After his death, the sheriff had Elmer McCurdy's body transported to Pawhuska, Oklahoma. There, he was taken to a local funeral home where owner and undertaker Joseph L. Johnson embalmed the body with an arsenic-based preservative typically used at the time to preserve a body for an extended period of time when no next of kin were immediately known. Johnson then shaved the dead outlaw's face, dressed the body in a suit, and stored it in the back of his funeral home, awaiting for a family member to claim him. But nobody did. Johnson refused to bury the body or release the corpse until he was paid for his services. As time went on and nobody came, the undertaker was determined to make his money, one way or the other. So, in a page right out of the P.T. Barnum playbook, Johnson propped the dead outlaw in the corner of the funeral home's back room, fashioned it with a rifle, and charged locals a nickel, which they would drop into the dead man's mouth for the opportunity. Girl! People are so fucking disgusting.
Yo, the past is wild.
Girl.
Like, really. Sometimes I forget how insane. Like, can you imagine doing this today? No.
No. For the opportunity to marvel at Johnson's handiwork and see what the undertaker dubbed the bandit who wouldn't give up. And because people are predictable and how disgusting they are, the bandit became a wildly popular attraction at the funeral home.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. At one point, even Johnson's children put the corpse on roller skates and rolled him around to chase smaller children as some sick, morbid prank.
Oh my God. What the fuck
is
wrong with people? No.
No. The trauma is so severe.
Weekend at Bernie's shit. No.
Oh, for sure. The Undertaker was making bank on viewings of his unclaimed gunslinger for 5 years.
Oh, my God.
Girl.
I'm speechless. I'm so flabbergasted right now. How? Yeah.
This attraction drew the attention of several carnival promoters who offered to purchase the mummified body with the intention of taking it on the road where he will be displayed for audiences on the carnival circuit for a fee. But Johnson refused. He wasn't going to give up his cash cow. Then on October 6, 1916, a man claiming to be Elmer's long-lost brother from California named Aver contacted Johnson to claim McCurdy's body. He had already contacted the Osage County Sheriff and a local attorney to get permission to take custody of McCurdy's remains and ship it to San Francisco for a proper burial. The following day, Aver arrived at the funeral home with another man who introduced himself as Wayne, also McCurdy's brother. Johnson bid farewell to his star attraction and released the body to the men, who then put it on a train for San Francisco. Except Elmer McCurdy didn't go to San Francisco. And Aver and Wayne weren't Elmer's siblings. They were James and Charles Patterson, owners of the Great Patterson Carnival Shows, a traveling carnival. After hearing about the wildly popular Embalmed Bandit exhibit, the two men concocted a scheme to acquire the body to feature it in their traveling carnival. The carnival owners had heard through the grapevine that the undertaker refused to sell the body to anyone, suspected that he would be willing to part with it if Elmer McCurdy's relatives came to claim him. So the men posed as McCurdy's siblings, and once they got a hold of the dead outlaw's body, shipped the corpse to Arkansas City, Kansas, where the dead bandit, billed as the outlaw who would never be captured alive, headlined Patterson's Carnival. It was through the carnival circuit that Elmer achieved a type of immortality. Despite the fact that he'd never successfully blown a safe in his life, in death, Patterson's Carnival touted him as a cowboy, a train robber, an outlaw. Elmer's body was even placed next to an exhibit of Billy the Kid. In 1922, Patterson sold his operation to Louis Sunny, who used McCurdy's corpse in a traveling museum of crime, which featured wax replicas of famous outlaws such as Bill Doolin and Jesse James. In 1928, the corpse was part of the official sideshow that accompanied the Trans-American Foot Race, one of the earliest 20th century multi-day races. It started at Legion Ascot Speedway in Los Angeles and finished at Madison Square Garden in New York City, for a total distance of 3,423.5 miles. And Elmer McCurdy's body was showcased every step of the way. In 1933, McCurdy's body was acquired by film director Darwin Esper to promote his exploitation film, Narcotic! The corpse, completely mummified by this point, was placed in theater lobbies where it was labeled, quote, dead dope fiend, end quote, whom Esper claimed had killed himself in a police standoff. I wish you guys could see Amy. Her head is in her hands. Like, she can't handle it.
I just, like, keep, like, popping up and shaking my head and then, like, going back down and covering my eyes. I just, like, what is this story?
Girl, I fucking know.
This is, like, a drug trip.
Yeah.
Have they made this into a movie?
We're going to get into it.
Okay.
Whom Esper claimed had killed himself in a police standoff after he had robbed a drugstore to support his habit. Esper capitalized on the mummified body's appearance. Its skin had become hard and shriveled, causing the body to shrink, which, girl, can you imagine seeing this?
This can't smell good either, right?
I can't imagine.
I know it's been treated and preserved to a
unless
certain
it
extent,
just
but like,
is so old that it doesn't have a smell anymore because it's not technically rotting.
Maybe. Ugh. None of this is okay.
No, definitely not.
Say that for the record.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, no, it's not. So his shriveled skin had caused the body to shrink, which Esper claimed was proof positive of the alleged dope fiend's drug use. After Louis Sunny died in 1949, Elmer McCurdy's corpse was placed in storage in a warehouse in Los Angeles. In 1964, Sunny's son, Dan, loaned the corpse to filmmaker David F. Friedman, where the dead gunslinger made his film debut with a brief appearance in Friedman's 1967 film, She Freak. So I'm just going to add this in here. It's not clear if Dan Sunny knew that this was an actual human body. His dad ran a wax museum after all, that featured tons of wax figures, with Elmer McCurdy being among them. And again, his body was mummified, and his skin is so hard that he didn't look or feel like a human body. Not only that, but bodies that end up in water or soil with the right enzymes can have their fat turned into wax. When the rest of the body decays, it leaves just the skeleton covered in thick deposits of tan or grayish-white, quote-unquote, soap, such as is the case with soap mummies, whose bodies have converted fat deposits into a waxy substance. And multiple reports have said that McCurdy's corpse was covered in wax. And I don't know if that was wax naturally formed or if the elder Sonny coated the body in wax to make him fit the aesthetic of his wax museum. In 1968, Dan sold the body along with other wax figures for $10,000 to Spoonie Singh, the owner of the Hollywood Wax Museum, who, it appears, was not aware that this wax figure in particular was actually human remains. Singh obtained the figures for two Canadian men who showcased them at a show at Mount Rushmore?
What?
Girl. What? Girl.
None of this makes sense.
Girl,
all
I know.
All of this sounds made up. I'm not yes. gonna lie.
I mean, yes, it does, because it's crazy. But while being featured there, a windstorm came through and damaged the corpse, blowing off Elmer's fingers, toes, and the tips of his ears.
Stop it, Monique. Stop it. What is this story?
I know.
This might be the most insane thing you've ever said.
It's pretty. It's up there.
This story is like definitely like top five for me.
It's fucking nuts. I can't. Yeah.
I can't. My head's back in my hands. I can't. No.
The men eventually returned the corpse to Singh as they determined that not only did the wax figure of the dead outlaw look too gruesome, but that, in the irony of ironies, it didn't look lifelike enough to display. So Singh took the body back to his wax museum in Los Angeles, where he posed the outlaw lying in an open casket before eventually selling it to Ed Liersch, part owner of the Pike Amusement Park in Long Beach, California. By 1976, Elmer McCurdy's corpse was put into a contraption in a haunted house where he'd appear to twitch and jiggle as the cars rode by.
Oh my God. What the Girl. Fuck, Monique? What the Girl. Fuck?
This is, yeah.
Every time I think Girl. Like we've reached the pinnacle, nope, there's some no. more fucked up details coming.
Yeah. With the new position came a new name, and he was given the moniker of the Thousand-Year-Old Man. Eventually, Elmer's kitschy name was taken away. His body was coated with several layers of orange glow-in-the-dark paint and hanged from a noose. The famed train-robbing outlaw, who had headlined the carnival circuit for decades, had been reduced to nothing more than a haunted house prop hanging in the laugh-in-the-dark funhouse ride at the Pike, until his identity was eventually uncovered after the unsettling dismemberment during the filming of The $6 Million Man. After Elmer McCurdy's remains were identified, the Oklahoma Historical Society arranged for McCurdy to be transported to Guthrie, Oklahoma, where on April 22, 1977, more than 65 years after his death, the much-traveled Elmer McCurdy was finally laid to rest in Summit View Cemetery. A funeral procession was conducted to transport McCurdy to the Boot Hill section of the cemetery, and a graveside service attended by 300 people was conducted, after which McCurdy was buried next to fellow bandit Bill Doolin of the Wild Bunch Gang. While Doolin was undoubtedly the more successful of the two gangsters in life, the Wild Bunch's career couldn't hold a candle to Elmer McCurdy's nearly 100-year journey to the grave. To make doubly sure that Elmer's corpse wouldn't be stolen or otherwise find its way back into show business, the state medical examiner ordered that 2 cubic yards of cement be poured over the coffin before the grave was closed. And by all accounts, McCurdy hasn't been seen hanging around any amusement park since. Elmer McCurdy may have been a failure as an outlaw, but he found the success and money he so desperately craved in life after his death, when his body traveled across the U.S. as a premier sideshow attraction for 65 years. His story has been told numerous times all over the world in television shows and books alike, including The Life and Afterlife of Elmer J. McCurdy, a melodrama in two acts in 1977, and the 2003 book Elmer McCurdy, The Life and Afterlife of an American Outlaw. And starting on February 28th, 2024, exactly 1 week after we are recording this, the latest musical from the creators of the 2018 Tony Award-winning musical, The Band's Visit, Dead Outlaw, about the life and wildly eventful afterlife of Elmer McCurdy, is set to go into previews at Minetta Lane Theater right here in Manhattan. And that is the story of Elmer McCurdy, who even 113 years after his death proved to be the bandit who wouldn't give up.
I think my brain exploded a little bit on that one. Oh my God. That was so, so insane and so disturbing and so fascinating.
Yeah.
They made a musical out of it, though?
Sure did.
I don't know how I feel about that.
And this isn't some hokey shit. This is fucking Tony Award winners made this shit.
I kind of want to go. I hate myself, but like, okay.
Girl, I'm going. Absolutely.
That was insane. There are no other words.
It's insane.
How have I never heard of this before?
So I knew the bare bones, no pun, of the story. I knew that there was an outlaw who someone killed him, came to get the reward, didn't get paid. So was like, fuck you, I'm going to get my money. And like ran him through the carnival circuit. And he ended up in a haunted house in like somewhere, like a billion years later. That's all I knew about it. I didn't know the details, like the specifics of it, and that he was like the worst trade and bank robber ever.
That part was a little funny, I'm not gonna lie.
That was amazing. Yeah,
I like keep just picturing the corpse on roller skates, and that is going to haunt my dreams, I think.
Yeah, I only saw that detail I only found that detail with NPR, probably because it's too horrifying for
NPR was like, we don't give a fuck, you need the facts. Oh, love them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And apparently there was a situation on one of the carnival shows where a patron ripped off his arm and then like chased his like secretary with it and like hit her with it or some shit.
Nothing surprises me in the story anymore.
No, because people are the worst.
I loved that story so much. It was so weird and so morbid, but oh my God, this is one of those things that I'm going to just like burst out at any opportunity and tell people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to think wherever he is, if there's an afterlife, being like, you know, mama, I made it to off-Broadway. You know what I mean? Like, I really hope that's the case.
I had a hell of a run.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good for him. They really did him dirty though.
Oh yeah, totally. They totally did. Yeah.
Damn, I feel bad for Elmer, but I'm glad he's getting the recognition he deserves finally.
Yeah, let me read you what the bio is on like playbill.com for this thing.
Also, I do actually really want to go see this now. This seems insane.
Same, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. We'll plan a date with all of the free time we have.
We'll make some goddamn free time.
Synopsis. Elmer McCurdy was an ambitious turn-of-the-20th-century outlaw whose death at the hands of a Western posse ended a life of failed crime and alcoholism and began a brilliant career as a mummified sideshow attraction that traveled the USA for decades. By the time this journey ended, his name had been forgotten and his desiccated body was hanging in a House of Horrors ride at an amusement park in Southern California, spray-painted day-glow orange. Then one day, a grip for the $6 million man TV show jostled what he thought was, quote unquote, just a dummy, and an arm fell off, revealing a human bone and beginning the hunt for the origins of this enigma. So they're literally like not taking any sort of artistic license. It seems like it's like, this is what it is.
You don't need to take artistic license with this. this story sounds like it's made up. It sounds like a movie from the 80s where people just like railed lines of cocaine nonstop for 48 hours. Yes. And then they were like, I got it. I got a story for you. Hear me out.
Yeah. This is one of those that you hear about every now and then that people leave out details from a story because like if they do like a TV show because it's too fucking nuts and like no one would actually believe this.
Yeah. They need to make like a mini series about this.
Yeah.
Now. Right now.
Well, next week we can go see the musical, girl.
I'm still like half speechless and shaking my head. I can't wrap my brain around the absolute insanity that was that story.
Yeah. It's fucking nuts.
Thank you so much though. That like put me on like a little bit of a high this week. Like that that was so wild.
I got you.
It had so many just like wonderfully insane details that I will never forget it. I'll never forget them.
Yeah. You're welcome.
God, you knocked it out of the park. Like, slow fucking clap.
Thank you.
I love you. You know what I like.
I love you. And it's so funny because as I was reading the story, there was like so many psychic sister moments too, because it was like, oh, this also like has a barn where he's like holed up in. And also like this is so fun. I love this.
I love this. I thought my inner tube bank robbery story was crazy. Like, yeah. Monique was like, I see your inner tube and I raise you so much. I pick a thing.
The difference is that the inner tube bank robbery was successful.
Oh, that's true.
Whereas this guy just blew up all his money.
And then just got fucking his mummified corpse dragged around the country for the next 65 years. Like, what?
And having his like fingers blown off by a windstorm on Mount Rushmore. What is that? It's like, it's like a shitty movie from like the fucking late 90s, early aughts.
Yes. But also like the kind of movie that I would just like morbidly watch over and over again.
10,000% on repeat. Every showing. Absolutely.
I love you so, so much. Thank you again for that story. That was just chef's kiss.
Thank you so much. I love you so much. I love an animal story, especially when animals are like, bitch, listen the fuck up.
Right?
There's some ghosties in this house.
I know. I didn't want one where any of the animals died. Like the cat died, but I believe of natural causes. Like,
yep.
Fine. But yeah, I love when animals are like, are you seeing that over there? No?
And especially I never thought of like, they've not been programmed to ignore it. That's so fascinating.
I loved that fact. Same. When I read that, I was like, oh shit, you're right. We have been brainwashed a little bit.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we love you guys. This is another fucking horror podcast. I'm Monique Sanchez.
And I'm Amy Traden.
You can find me on the gram at pinupgirlmo.
You can find me at lobotomy, and that's lobot period Amy.
Follow the show on the gram, especially since in the next few weeks, we're going to be putting out some cool information about some cool shit that we're doing. I don't know. You might want to be on that.
Some, like, secret stuff we've been working on. Yeah.
I don't know. NBD. Whatever. Do that shit.
Don't worry about it. But, like, also follow so you can find out what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Just be cute and casual about it. You can find us on the gram at Another Fucking Horror Podcast. Every sixth episode, we do a True Listener Tales episode where we read you your true crazy story. So if you have one or you just want to say hi, email us at anotherfuckinghorrorpodcast@gmail.com with a period instead of the you and fucking. And if you like this show, tell a friend, tell two friends, but definitely rate, review, and subscribe. Reviews are a really great way to help us gain visibility. And the more people that know about us, the more people can listen to us so that maybe sooner rather than later, we could do the show full time. Guys, we're so obsessed with you. Thanks for being rad as fuck. Keep it cute.
Keep it creepy.
Bye.